from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro in for Michael Krasny. On October 29, 1969, computers at Stanford and UCLA connected for the first time, the birthday, if you will, of the Internet. What a half decade it's been, spawning Silicon Valley here in the Bay Area, a thing which quickly moved past its academic infancy to become an economic ecosystem, making one dent in the universe after another, changing the way we communicate with each other, study, work, shop, and live. 50 years on, with most of us now dominated by megacorporations, those who understand the Internet best are asking us to think a little harder about what we want connected computers to do for us in the next 50 years. That's coming up after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro. In 50 years, the Internet has changed the way we communicate with each other, study, work, and shop. But it's also exacerbated analog inequities, spawned an uncontrolled surveillance economy, and increasingly sophisticated attacks on democracy around the world. So what do we want connected computers to do for us in the next 50 years? Well, we've brought along a fabulous panel of experts to talk about the possibilities, the fears, the hopes, the dreams, including Amy Webb, quantitative futurist, professor of strategic foresight at the NYU Stern School of Business, and founder of the Future Today Institute, author of The Big Nine, How the Tech Titans and Their Thinking Machines Could Warp Humanity. Amy, thank you for being here.
Thanks, Rachel.
We've got in studio Cindy Kahn, executive director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And last but not least, Andrew Keene, author whose books include How to Fix the Future, The Internet is Not the Answer, and the forthcoming Tomorrow Versus Yesterday.
All right.
Oh, my goodness. Well, gosh, I could spend an hour with each one of you, but why don't we start with, I guess, digital inequality, the haves and the have-nots. Any thoughts along this line? Andrew, you want to kick us off?
Well, I think in the beginning, everyone worried that the big inequality would be between people who were wired, the wealthy, the powerful, and people who weren't, the underclass. But actually, the reverse is true. Real power in the 21st century will lie with the unwired. The underclass are the one most addicted to the garbage on the Internet, to the free services, to the surveillance infrastructure of the Internet. So inequality, the power lies with the new analog class. Wealthy people, for example, send their kids to schools where the Internet isn't allowed, and only the wealthy will be able to afford to emancipate themselves from the electronic network.
Amy Webb, as you're listening to that, does it strike you as on point or too dark?
Well, I mean, I think it's important for us to think through how we got to now and what that portends for what's to come. You know, we're living in an age of algorithmic determinism, in part because as the Internet was built and built for commercial purposes, there wasn't a lot of risk modeling to think through what the downstream implications might be. So in addition to what Andrew said, which I think is correct, and that is that only, you know, the wealthiest and the most technically digitally savvy will be able to opt out from some of the persistent surveillance systems, I think it is still very important for us all to understand that everybody is being scored. And that's because in a free market economy, we, you know, one in which we have so many different options, we've allowed our privacy in some ways to be commoditized. You know, and everybody alive today is in some way being scored at you know, with every single, you know, keystroke, every single time they look at a mobile device. And it's not, it doesn't necessarily have to be bad. You know, the machines that are automated in some way have to use data to make decisions. I think the challenge here and the challenge going forward is understanding how those decisions are being made, because, you know, we're in a very opaque situation right now. And maybe Cindy wants to chime in, because the EFF has been all over this and I think doing a tremendous job helping to inform the public.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. That's really kind. And we certainly have been trying really hard to uncover and explain how algorithmic decision making is made so that we can empower, you know, ourselves as a society to make different decisions than the ones that are being made for us right now. One of the things I'd like to flag on this that I think goes to Andrew's point is that in the privacy realm, there's a lot of efforts to try to solve the privacy problem by getting us to pay for privacy. And it's one of the things that I think we as a society need to watch very, very closely and make sure we aren't doing. The buying your way out of being surveilled as a strategy to deal with the mass surveillance system is horribly biased and prejudiced and disproportionately affects the poor. We know that the poor have traditionally been overly affected by surveillance even before the digital age, but now we've turbocharged it. So as people are hearing for ideas or proposals about how to regain our privacy in the digital age, they ought to watch for these pay-to-privacy schemes and make sure we really reject them strongly.
It does seem as a culture, especially here in the U.S., there's a kind of fascination, a worship with the idea of technology. So many, you know, whether it's a police department or a retailer, you could say AI, artificial intelligence, you know, we've taken it out of the human hands. Oh, you know, the best decisions possible will be made by the computer or the software. And, you know, leaving aside this question of garbage data in, garbage data out.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, look, I think that AI systems are good for certain kinds of problems. And one of the things that's happening right now with all the hype is that, you know, when all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And so there's a lot of attempts to try to put AI into decision-making that it really shouldn't be in. And I think there are a couple of things to think about in that regard. One is AI is really bad at predicting how humans are going to act in the future. It can only tell you how humans have acted in the past, and that's actually not a good measure. And so there's a lot of danger in future predictions or things that are trying to like map your face and say what your emotions are. These are predictive, basically fundamentally predictive kinds of ideas for AI that are really, really dangerous. And the second thing that's really dangerous is when the people who get affected by AI decisions are not the people who are deploying them. And that's another way to think about like what's a good use of AI and what's not. If you're using AI for your own purposes about trying to decide what's going on in your own system, there's lots of good things you can do with predictive, with the pattern recognition kind of predictions in AI. But if you're affecting other people who aren't in the system and don't understand how it works, or even I just think people who aren't controlling the system, that's when you can go really wrong really fast.
I think that it may not be a very good system, but that doesn't mean governments won't use it. And what we're seeing in China is the pioneering of a really, really, really terrible kind of 21st century Orwellian system where they're using both AI and facial recognition and every other technology to strengthen their authoritarian, perhaps even totalitarian state. And what's really creepy is there are private companies in the US, Amazon in particular comes to mind, who are themselves championing this, maybe not in the political sphere, but in the workplace. I think the workplace will in the 21st century become the kind of the battleground for privacy. It will be outside of the consumer space. And one other thing to add on the AI area is that it does perpetuate inequality. The way in which AI works is it will perpetuate sexual inequality, racial inequality, inequality between age groups and generations, because as we've already learned, it only knows the past, so it can only work off bias, essentially.
Amy, I heard you trying to get in there earlier.
It's a little challenging. I'm calling you from a family home in Chicago. I'm not in the studio. So you know, when it comes to artificial intelligence, there's a tremendous amount of misplaced optimism and fear. And so we tend to fall back on the wonderful storytelling that we've grown up with and that we've seen on the screen and that we've read. I just want to sort of temper the conversation just a bit by saying that AI itself is not harmful. We're simply talking about the third era of computing and machines that use data or systems that use data to make decisions autonomously. And the reality is that we've been living with artificial intelligence for a very, very long time. The anti-lock brake systems in your car anybody who at any point during the holiday season got on a plane, you know, from controls in the cockpit to the way that your tickets were generated and the prices that you paid. So AI is not something that's off on a distant horizon. We're in the process of a seven-decade transition between programmable systems and an era in which much more is automated, you know, and much of which we can't see. Now, the challenge here is in thinking through, again, the implications of the decisions that are made building those systems and how they're deployed. You could argue that, yes, what's happening in China is awful. You know, just a couple of days ago, if you have to register your face and submit biometric data in order to have an account so that you can use the internet and a mobile device. So, you know, that's obviously not great, and it sort of goes up against our Western democratic ideals. That being said, you know, there's a part of me that is thinking to myself, well, at least they're transparent about it. We are all being surveilled and scored in many of the same ways outside of China. It's just that it's not transparent. I mean, you know, there's the obvious surveillance when you see a camera, but truth be told, you know, these companies don't need a camera to recognize you. They don't need to see you in order to understand you and to start mining and refining your behavioral biometrics so that decisions can be made on your behalf.
Cindy, that's a very good point.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess I would say that we don't have to say China's okay in order to say that our system is bad. I think that when you look at what's happening with the Uyghurs, and you look at what's happening in Hong Kong, I think it's a very good wake-up call for Americans about who kind of tended to only think about the good things at technology and only been sold the good things. And so it's a window for us. But it's actually a horrible human rights problem right now, and one that I think, you know, the leaked information out of the Uyghur situation shows that the Chinese are not actually even all that transparent about what and how they're doing things. I mean, the social scoring is presented in a domestically a very different than the way we see it. So, but I don't think that we have to. That's fine. I mean, I think that it's a good example of how these systems, some of the systems that we're using domestically, can go wrong in ways that are very easily understandable to the rest of the world, and we should, both fight that human rights abuse and fight the stuff at home. It's not an either or.
Amy, I do want to let you come back there, but also raising another point that this example provides, which is that, you know, what we perceive as the internet is very different depending on where you live and what device you're using. We're all sort of functioning to a certain extent in walled gardens, you know, either of the government's making or companies making.
That's right. And, you know, I should also say that I lived and worked in China for a while. I also lived and worked in Japan. So I spent quite a bit of time there. You know, and by no means am I saying that the human rights situation, which is deplorable, is anything to make light of. You know, it's wonderful that we're finally that the outside world is finally starting to hear and pay attention to the awful situation of the Uyghurs in the West. But the truth is, you know, there are countless intermediaries. I think, you know, when people, you know, when a technology becomes so useful, it becomes invisible, and there's just not a lot of awareness when somebody is looking at their device, they're downloading a free game, or they're connecting, you know, cameras into their homes, outside of their homes. There are countless intermediaries that move each packet of data along the way, and those systems are not always transparent, nor are they secure. And part of what I was saying at the beginning was, you know, as with every technology, if we don't think through all of the negative ways in which it can be deployed, we tend to, much later on in the process, you know, become upset that things didn't turn out the way that we wanted. You know, and so every time you use any device, you know, the internet is not sort of a single simple place, a single garden like it, you know, it was at some point in the very beginning. It's complex. And in fact, you know, we did some research a couple of years ago on the emergence of splinternets, which is a way of saying that the internet now behaves a little differently depending on where geographically you are, because the regulatory environment has you know, bloomed in very different ways all around the world. In Europe, there's a regulatory framework called the GDPR, which is very, very restrictive. And Europe has always been on the forefront of privacy regulation, which is interesting. However, it's not being deployed or enforced exactly the same in every local community. It's really left up to local officials. So, you know, depending on where in the world you are, you're going to see different kinds of information. And the irony here is that, in part, a lot of these restrictions and regulations were intended to help shore up some of the problems that we now have with false information. I would argue that, you know, the opposite has happened, that it's actually causing misinformation in some cases to flourish.
I disagree with that. I think that we should celebrate the splinternet. I think that, you know, I like the EFF and all the rest of it, but, you know, John Barry Barlow's famous declaration of cyberspace independence in the mid-90s suggested that we should celebrate this global network. And it was always a kind of, very much of an American internationalist delusion. And I think the splinternet is a good thing in the sense that it reflects national laws and local cultures. That doesn't mean that I'm celebrating, say, what's happening in Russia, where they're cutting the internet off from the rest of the world. But I think if we can get beyond this kind of internationalist utopianism and recognize that the reality of the digital 21st century will be one of fragmentation into nation states and local cultures, I don't think that's a bad thing.
Well, I do. I think that there is a space for local control of some things. But, you know, we still work every day with people all around the world who are desperate to get their voices out, whether that's trying to get people in Iran who are facing shutoffs, people, the Uyghurs, Hong Kong. You know, there are people all around the world who still believe that, and I think rightfully so, that digital infrastructure can help them get their voices heard, get their stories told, and stop repression. And, you know, there definitely are uses of technology to enforce repression, but that doesn't mean the other side doesn't exist. And, you know, we spend a lot of our energy at EFF trying to help people get their voices out. Those people have not gone away. And I think it's a bit of there sometimes is a sense when I'm sitting in the United States that people are like, well, we need to just shut people up online. And I think that that's a very easy thing to say if you're sitting in a place where your voice is going to – you've got lots of other ways to have your voice heard. But we still spend – there are a lot of people for whom the idea that you can reach a digital audience, that you can – somebody will hear your plea who might be in a position to help you, and that the digital networks have made that possible is still tremendously important, and I would say life and death important around the world.
Amy, do you want to chime in here?
Concrete example. Yeah. Here's the issue. The issue is that we have to think through the outcomes of the decisions that we make today, and we have to – I mean, it's challenging. You have to think sort of near and long term simultaneously, and you have to do that using data. So we are on the cusp as we enter a new decade of the rise of synthetic media. So, you know, if you think about all of the deep fakes that made the rounds for the past 2 years, this is something that's generative in nature, similar but a little different. So anybody who's familiar with Bermuda or Little Michaela, these are synthetic content, kind of like a soap opera that lives out online in places like Instagram. They have lots of followers. They are generated, although they're not AI derived, which is a way of saying they're not. There's still humans in the loop, but we're on the cusp of being able to now generate and modulate people's voices, their gait, their posture, and to develop new kinds of avatars and deploy them. So if you start thinking through the regulatory frameworks and an environment where the internet is splintered and everybody can dictate what the rules are in each individual place, stop and think for a moment what the consequences could be going forward. And on top of that, you know, because people are now concerned about their faces being scraped or their voices being scraped and misused, you know, there are now companies that are selling different ways to prevent that, but there are also companies that are trying to get around some of the existing regulations so that they could deploy similar versions of other people. There's a company called DID, which now creates fake digital copies of people. So this is kind of analogous to trying to get around the copyright restriction by changing a few notes in a song and then, you know, sampling it or re-releasing it. It's similar. You take a famous person, add a mustache, tweak their face just very slightly. It still clearly looks like them, but it's a little different, kind of like an uncanny valley, you know, slightly bit different. But you can do that, put words into their mouth and deploy them, and it gets around some of the copyright laws depending on country. That's why I'm saying we have to start thinking through. We have an opportunity now to think about the next 50 years of the internet. And anytime you start a new decade, it's a useful and easy time to contemplate what's to come. I would urge everybody to do that in a meaningful way.
But the reality is that international organizations, especially in the digital sphere, don't work. They're basically irrelevant or they're used by states. And the only solution to all this, I agree with you, Amy, these new technologies, synthetic technologies, are in terms of democracy and freedom, they are terrifying. But the only way to fix it is through government. So if you can look at what responsible governments are doing in Estonia, for example, or in Europe, that's the only solution. Digital networks don't work. And certainly we can't rely on private Silicon Valley companies whose focus is exclusively on their own economic upside.
I mean, I guess I would just say that you know, there's law, there's tech, there's governments, and there's companies. There's probably a couple other players. And I guess I feel like anybody who's asking you to just pick one to make the world better is kind of missing the opportunity to bring all of them to bear to make the world better. And the answer, you know, technology, you know, so, you know, we live in a tremendously insecure internet right now, right? Well, there's a technology. It's called encryption. I've been fighting to try to make it available to ordinary people since 93, that could help us if we deployed it well. That's a, you know, and EFF started a certificate authority to make the internet more secure. Technology can solve some problems. Some technologies can.
Well, we're talking about the internet at 50 with Amy Webb, quantitative futurist, Cindy Cohen, executive director of Electronic Frontier Foundation, and Andrew Keene, author of many books, including How to Fix the Future. We've been talking about the internet at 50, but I'd like to spend the next half hour talking about the internet at 100. Oh, I'm not sure. Does it sound scary? Give us a ring and tell us what your thoughts and questions are. 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch with us online, of course, on social media. We have a page on Facebook, on Twitter. We're at KQED Forum. Of course, if you're a Gen Xer, you can email your questions to forum@kqed.org. Whatever the case, stay with us and stay involved in the conversation. You're listening to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro, in for Michael Krasny, and we're talking about the internet at 50, or is it 100, with quantitative futurist Amy Webb, executive director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, Cindy Cohen, and Andrew Keene, an author whose books include very pertinent to our topic today, How to Fix the Future. And that is the question that we want to ask. We want to encourage you to call in and ask questions of our expert panel here today. 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can, of course, get in touch with us on Twitter, Facebook, and email, forum@kqed.org. With that, why don't we go straight to the phones? And Anne in Mountain View.
Hi. This is a really big issue for me. I really want to see the next age of computing care about temporal ergonomics, that is, the way technology interfaces with the time workflow and capabilities of finite people. And, you know, what I usually hear back from technologists is, A, we already do that. No, you don't. And B, that it's too hard because there's no economic model. But how do you know? Because you've never tried, is my answer. So, like, for example, if I had an AI assistant that had the legal training and could keep training, I could combat, like, anytime I came across just a simple example, end user license agreement or terms of some kind of terms of use, I could have the AI assistant tell me if that met my values, warn me of any pitfalls, and give me alternatives if I didn't like it. So I'm no longer up against a big room of lawyers and years of experience with my limited life and my time when I'm just trying to get something done. And the other thing is, you know, technologists need to remember that we're not all new users. You know, back in the day, it was okay to treat everybody like they were a new user. Anytime something new came out, you could obsolete everything. But if you're, somebody shows up at your front doorstep and whisks you away to a foreign country and a house you don't recognize with a lot of stuff that doesn't work the way all your stuff used to, and your family and your business are still back home, and you have to spend years limping along, getting them all back and keeping everything going, that's really different than if someone shows up to a college student who's sleeping on somebody's couch and puts them in a cool house with a swimming pool in a foreign country. You've got to stop treating us all like we're new users.
Thank you for that, Amy. I want to let Amy jump in here. I mean, Anne brings up a really good point, this sort of interface, how do we make it work for us? I'm thinking right away of, Amazon's warehouses, where I think a lot of the human workers there would say AI is making their life, in robotics really, making their life a living hell because their managers expect them to function like robots do.
Sure. So I'll address that, but then I think I'd love to highlight a potential solution.
Sure.
So I think when, our human brains are somewhat cognitively limited. And so because we crave and recognize patterns, it's very difficult for us to escape all of the stories that we've been told. And the stories that we've been told are that, robots, walking, talking, anthropomorphized computers are going to either come and murder us in our sleep, or they're going to come and take all of our jobs. The story that we haven't really been told, but which seems to be much more likely, at least in the near future, is that humans will be reduced to robot-like tasks because in our human evolution, over many, many, many years, we've evolved to be energy efficient and to be pretty good at repetitive tasks, although our resources and our energy may be somewhat finite. As it turns out, the cognitive tasks are much better suited at the moment to some of our automated decision-making systems, our AIs. So what we're starting to see in places like Amazon warehouses is that the cognitive decisions are being made by systems, and humans are the ones sort of functioning at this point like robots. It's not the other way around. And to me, that portends a far more dystopian future than I have heard anybody discuss yet. To me, that is terrifying because it means that, if we don't have the ability to make choices, to some extent, we lose our humanity. Now, I do have a possible solution, at least when it comes to the terms of service. And my assumption is that Cindy is going to know far better than I do whether or not this is a particular good idea, or maybe the EFF has something. So there's a website called tosdr.org. Terms of service didn't read. It's a browser extension, and you can run it, and it'll tell you where and when the terms of service on various websites have changed. It's a cool little tracker that I've used before, and it has some labeling options. And at least if you're trying to stay on top of things that have changed, that's one way to do it. But Cindy may have a better sense on that.
I mean, I think that, again, the solution to technology is not technology. So Amy introduced this dystopian idea that we're all turning into computers, which to me, a lot of people already seem to be like computers with or without.
I said robots.
Yeah. Well, whatever. They seem to be the same thing these days. So, and then she's saying, well, the solution is, some sort of technology. It isn't. The solution are human beings. The solution us manifesting our agency and controlling the technology before that technology controls us. The idea, we keep on falling into the same trap. Well, we've screwed up the world so through technology, so the solution is more technology, blockchain, Bitcoin, the internet, blah, blah, blah. And they always deepen the problem. The solution to all this technology are human beings. The solution is agency. The solution is us shaping this technology to our needs rather than the interests of the owners of the technology.
Well, I certainly agree that the answer is that we regain control of technology and that that the technology serves us, not the other way around. I think that's tremendously important. And in terms of your AI assistant that the caller mentioned, I think that people have been trying to build that for a long time, and I think it would be a tremendous thing. But it's a good example of taking this technology and putting it in you're in control of it, right? It's serving you. You're in control of it. And its only job is to give you what you want. It doesn't have a secondary interest. And too many of the technologies that we've seen now that are tracking technologies have, pretend to give you email, but really, Google's a data collection company at this point, and they happen to give you email or documents or other things. And so having those two goals, that's a good sign that something's not quite working for you. It's funny, this TOS browser extension that Amy mentioned is actually an ongoing project that started with an EFF project called TOSBack, where we were tracking changes in terms of service. And I think that continuing to think along these lines is helpful. I don't think you can empower people unless they get informed about things. I'm not sure that mere information, just understanding that you're being screwed is enough to stop you from being screwed, but it's a necessary first step.
Andrew, I would say, I don't want to come to a gunfight with a knife. If the powers that be are using technology, I want to be using technology too, but for my best interest.
Well, I think the caller also fell into another trap, which is, she sounded very disempowered. I don't know whether she actually is, but she sounded very sad with her life. And she said, well, I need AI to help me fight off the lawyers. Two mistakes with that. Firstly, that AI is going to be owned by someone else who are going to be figuring out ways of monetizing it. And secondly, she should be hiring lawyers and paying for them, because the crisis will be that all these AIs replacing the old sort of the old meritocratic establishment of the industrial age, lawyers, engineers, doctors, these people are all going to be replaced by AI, and AI is going to be owned by Salesforce or Google or Amazon or one of these other behemoths. So I think we've got to get beyond the idea of thinking about technology as saving us money and doing away with work or workers. It's a very dangerous delusion.
Well, I would agree with some of that, but I do think that the idea that there are contractual terms to everything that we do for basic life is somewhat new. In terms of the way that it's played out, it's a shift from owning things to licensing things, and then you get licensing terms. So I think there's tons of terms of service that we need to have a governmental floor for what you can put in the realm of contract and contract away, right? We don't let people sell themselves into slavery. We have we have limits to what you can contract away. And I think in terms of the online environment right now, we've kind of checked out of the idea that there are limits to what people can contract away in terms of their data, what can be happened to it with follow on. As I said, first uses, secondary uses, tertiary uses that we don't understand. I think there is a role to try to not have to hire a lawyer personally, but actually set laws in places where these kinds of agreements have limits to how abusive they can be. And the EFF has spent a lot of time dealing with abusive terms of service, trying to draw attention to them and trying to get the idea that there are that just because it's in a contract doesn't mean that you agreed to it or that you should be bound to it in the ways that we do contracts now, which are dramatically different from when I learned contract law in law school, and the idea that two people sit around the table and they negotiate back and forth. Like, we are so far from that paradigm, and we need to have the way that the law interacts with terms of service recognize the difference between that kind of canonical historical idea of contract and where we are now.
Lawyers are good things. My girlfriend's a lawyer.
Amy, I'm hearing that law, that regulation matters, makes a difference.
Well, here's where it's going to sound like I'm going to contradict everything that I've said so far on the show today. I actually think that in many cases, regulatory action is not the best possible way forward. It's been my experience that the traditional levers of regulation work really well when you're talking about more abstract concepts. When we're talking about something like not a technology, but a group of technologies, in this case, artificial intelligence, that are still in the process of evolving, that are still very much a moving target, the challenge is that trying to regulate the end uses, and the sort of next order implementations or uses of those technologies become really difficult. And so what we tend to see is that I would argue that at least in the United States, we don't have a single epicenter of power, but that we have three. We have Washington, D.C., where our laws are made. We have the left coast, where all of the technology is made, from L.A. all the way up to Bellevue. And we have New York, which is our financial center. And my academic background is game theory. And to me, this represents a really nice three-sided prisoner's dilemma, where each one believes that they have the most power. And in reality, if they were only collaborating and cooperating in a meaningful way, everybody would stand to gain quite a bit more. And so our lawmakers tend to ignore technology until something happens. And then way late in the game, they decide to get involved. There's an adversarial relationship between the Valley and D.C., while meantime, there are ridiculous expectations from the financial sector on returns. So if you're continually prioritizing speed over safety and you're not giving anybody the ability to do the risk modeling, why is it any surprise that at some point technology forks and does stuff we don't want it to do? So traditional regulation after the fact is just not going to work. We have to come up with much more sophisticated ways of thinking because, self-policing has already proven not to work. But trying to develop regulations that are continually trying to keep pace with the ever-evolving nature of tech is also not a reasonable way forward.
Well, we've got a lot of comments coming in, and I want to give listeners an opportunity to join the conversation. Noelle asks, how do I evade surveillance from my internet-enabled devices? And another listener asks, how can a customer protect against the unwarranted use of voice verification as used by companies like Wells Fargo? Cindy, this sounds like mm-hmm. something you might be able to jump in on.
Sure. I mean, I think that there are some things you can do to help evade surveillance over your systems. But honestly, what we have to do is there aren't individual solutions to mass surveillance at this point, whether that's the technology you bring in your home or the government's mass surveillance of the internet, which I spend a lot of time on. We need to join together and put some limits on these kinds of things. So, at the very low level, if there's two-factor authentication, turn it on. If there are other security options that you can get by parsing through your systems, turn them on.
Delete your cookies on a regular basis.
Yeah, use EFF has a plugin called Privacy Badger, but there are other that works for Firefox and Chrome that can block third-party cookies. But that's a cat and mouse game. It's important to do it, but also not to think that you are completely immune to surveillance with those kinds of things, because we need, as a society, to say no to some things. We need strong. I hear Amy about the limits of regulation. I especially think in the area of AI, it's important to think seriously about those kinds of things. But there's other areas where we actually can have law help us. And again, the trick isn't picking one. The trick is picking the right one for the problem. And when it comes to privacy, EFF has long supported stronger privacy protections that empower users and give us a way to say no to tracking.
What do you make of California's new law, which is coming into effect?
The California law is coming into effect, although there's another one that Alistair McTaggart is putting on the ballot as well. So I think it's still an open question. We spent spent a lot of the last year trying to both defend the California law from efforts to try to weaken it, both in California and federally, and try to strengthen it. And we had a Privacy for All bill that EFF and a bunch of the privacy advocates put together. We ended in a stalemate. None of our attempts to make it better passed, but none of their attempts to make it worse passed either. So the privacy law is going to go into effect, but it's still a developing story, and there's still a lot to be done. And there's actually a couple of federal privacy laws that have just been introduced that are better than the ones we've seen before, which have been just efforts to try to dumb down it. So,
we'll see if those get passed.
Yeah.
I do want to give Andrew a chance to jump in here. I see you chomping at the bit.
Yeah, because I think Amy dangled something that sounded very sexy and attractive, that we're going to come up with some, I think, quoting her, she said, particularly sophisticated alternative solution. Well, the reality is there isn't one. We know this from 3,000 or 4,000 years of human history, that when we have these mass disruptions, whether it's the Industrial Revolution or many other scientific upheavals, the only fix is through government. And I think it's right. It's not the only fix. Government needs to work with consumers and entrepreneurs and innovators. We know that. But it has to come from government. And I think she's wrong also to suggest that there are three powers in the U.S. She said government, Wall Street, and West Coast tech. The reality is that West Coast tech and Wall Street are one and the same now. And that's the problem. And that's the challenge. And I think when we discard the idea of government as the solution, we're really opening the door to this alliance of Wall Street and Silicon Valley. And I think that's why politicians like Warren in particular, who have a very articulate and radical view of how tech is undermining democracy and equality, are really important people to listen to now.
Amy, do you want to jump in there?
Yeah, you know, there are a few things to untangle. One, to suggest that Wall Street and the tech sector are one and the same, I think, is incredibly reductive. They're very much at odds with each other. And while you do certainly have VCs based in the Valley, there are significant tensions that divide rather than bind the two. You know, there are ways forward that are not that do not use the regulatory frameworks that we've used in the past. And the problem is that what I tend to see coming out of Washington, D.C. and a lot of our lawmaking bodies is repetition using existing laws that have already passed or existing frameworks. I believe very strongly in public service and donate about 20% of my time back to public sector causes, and a lot of that has to do with our government in the United States, where I spend a ton of time. And we can't keep writing regulatory frameworks that have some kind of basis in what worked before. We are facing something that's fundamentally different. So, you know, traditional regulation, as a blanket way to deal with the problems that we have, is not the smartest solution. We have to figure out a way to incentivize everybody to come to the table, which is going to mean making some short-term sacrifices. It cannot simply come from D.C. or, you know, if you happen to be living somewhere else in the world, from your own local government. We have to figure out a way to incent all of the players to collaborate so that we put technology and we classify some of our technologies as a public good rather than continuing to only look at the commercial use cases. And that's going to take a different way of thinking. I've been working with different lawmakers in different parts of governments on ways to do this. But again, it's going to require everybody making some short-term sacrifices. It's just we have to think differently going forward.
Well, speaking of thinking differently going forward, as we round the bend towards the end of the hour, I want to throw out a question that Gary asks. How could climate change affect the next 50 years of the Internet?
That's an easy one.
Yeah. Anyone?
we're pointing at each other because we have no idea.
Speechless.
Well, I think it could. I think that for many of these things, it's up to us, right? I mean, I think that digital technologies can be a really helpful thing in, especially in moments of environmental disaster, right? In terms of disaster relief, in terms of letting people have the whole point about letting your voice heard to people outside of your local community in an environmental disaster or any other kind of disaster. That's one of the things that digital technologies give us that we didn't have before we had digital technologies. You couldn't have your voice heard by somebody halfway around the world instantaneously. That can be a good thing in moments of crisis. I think it can also help us muster resources from different physical places around the world, and already is, to try to fight climate change and analyze what's going on. But I don't think those are tools, and thinking of how we use digital technology as a tool towards the end. Many things around climate change we're not going to be able to fix by people just talking to each other. We're going to have to actually take actions, both kind of online and offline, to try to stem the tide.
And it shows again the power of government. I mean, we can all talk about the UN and all this globalism stuff, but the reality is that if we're going to fix the climate crisis, it has to be done at the national level, because that's where power is. Like it or not, that's the reality of the 21st century. We thought that the digital revolution would do away with nation states and replace it with some sort of digital international order. In fact, the reverse is true. I mean, the Chinese state or the Russian state or the Iranian state is a much stronger than they were in the 20th century in some ways.
Amy?
I just wanted to chime in on this, because I think the caller raised a very good question. Anytime that you are thinking about the future of anything, it's good to look from different perspectives. And so, in fact, we have a tool that we use called the 11 sources of macro change, and we try to look at the future of anything through the lenses of those different areas of change, because they show us inflection points and signals about what's to change. So if we think about the future of the internet through the lens of climate, there's a ton that we can be thinking about. We know that sea level rise is unpredictable. We know that some of our data centers are located in places that could be underwater. We know that over the next couple of years, there's an unprecedented number of micro and CubeSats that are going to be launched. These are tiny little satellites around the size of a Rubik's Cube that don't have the same payload as a traditional satellite. You launch them, they create a mesh network overhead and do all kinds of things, but one of the hopes that they might be able to do is to beam connectivity back down to the U.S. On the other hand, if we have continued issues with heat and with climate and all these other things, it may be more challenging and difficult to launch those devices. We've got in China, there's all kinds of really interesting but also very problematic experiments with ultra high voltage and long range wires as they attempt to, through some state initiatives, help build infrastructure in emerging markets around the world. But those emerging markets are places where there's probably going to be some climate migration. So as we think, we tend to use the term internet as a shorthand for how we now communicate in a modern age. It's useful for us to think about changes in areas like public health and education and geopolitics and geoeconomics and climate. As we start to think about over the next 50 years how we will communicate with each other and what potential opportunities and risks there are.
James asks, some technologists are skeptical of oncoming new technologies like 5G, autonomous cars, and AI, because the infrastructure and capacity for these technologies does not now exist or have any realistic plan for fast creation. Your thoughts?
Well, certainly EFF has been we've written a paper about 5G and why fiber to the home is a much better option. That 5G is a little, I would say, full of hype and also tends towards the companies that are already in power as opposed to decentralization. We haven't talked about that yet, but I think that one of the ways that we get power back is to try to re-decentralize the web, move away from walled gardens and controlled central technologies to protocols and ways that technologies can talk to each other that are not controlled by one company or another. So I do think that, but 5G is one that's kind of easy and old school, right? like, because that's, you know, the FCC and telecom. I think that thinking about how to get real fiber to the home as opposed to the kind of hype of 5G is something we think was important in kind of a whole other realm that we haven't talked about much yet, but around network neutrality and decentralization of power and control of our communication technologies.
Any last thoughts quickly, Andrew?
Well, I think network neutrality is one of the biggest non-issues. It's the ultimate red herring. And I think that 5G is a good thing. I think that fiber to the home is a luxury of wealthy states. And that a continent like Africa, for example, 5G could be profoundly transformative. I don't have any problem with 5G. And I don't also understand where the crisis of technology is in that sense. I mean, 5G exists. It's being developed. The interesting thing, obviously, about 5G is security. Huawei and Western companies like Ericsson, can we trust them to build out this infrastructure? But I think it exists. I don't think it's a problem.
Well, it's been a fabulous, sobering conversation with you guys today. I want to thank Amy Webb, quantitative futurist and professor of strategic foresight at the NYU Stern School of Business, Cindy Cohen, executive director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and Andrew Keen, the author whose books include How to Fix the Future, The Internet is Not the Answer, and the forthcoming Tomorrow versus Yesterday. This has just been a terrific, terrific conversation. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Tina Lauerberg, Ariana Prale, Susan Britton, Grace Wan, and Caroline Smith. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our intern is Sam Klein-Markman. Our executive editor is Ethan Lindsay. And our chief content officer is Holly Kernan. I'm Rachel Miro. You've been listening to Forum. Continue the conversation online. It's clearly one for the ages.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.